The case for argument this morning is Lusby against Rolls-Royce. To be correct, it's United States on the relation of Lusby against Rolls-Royce.
XREL.
Mr. McConnell.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, as the Court knows, I'm not the architect of the threshold issue that we're here before the Court on today as far as the res judicata issue is concerned, and that seems to be a threshold issue based on Cole that the appellees argued in the District Court. When we received this case and were asked to participate in the case, it had been pending for a substantial amount of time. We were aware that the original case that was brought by the Mr. Lusby, a personal wrongful termination case, retaliation case, had been dismissed, and had been dismissed with prejudice by a voluntary dismissal, a joint dismissal. When we looked at the case, which involves several different airplane parts for turbine engines and jet engine aircraft, turbine blades in particular, we were aware that all dismissals of the FCA claims must have government approval. And we were aware that the claim of Mr. Lusby, that this is issue here, Lusby 2, had been filed sometime before the...
I don't understand the significance of this. If there was some problem in the dismissal of the first suit, the thing to do was file a timely notice of appeal. One can't say the first suit shouldn't have been dismissed, and therefore we can just ignore the fact that it was dismissed. That's a frontal challenge on the concept of res judicata.
One can't
avoid res judicata by saying the first decision was wrong.
No, I'm saying the first...
Propriety is established.
I'm saying the first case was properly dismissed, that there was no requirement that the FCA claim be brought within that first case. This is clearly... We've not found any law that says you must bring an FCA claim.
Res judicata doesn't depend on a compulsory joinder notion. Nothing compulsory about the idea of merger and bar. One is free to bring a claim or not, but if it's part of the same claim, it's barred in the second suit. I would think your argument is not... doesn't have anything to do with whether something is compulsory or whether the first dismissal was correct, but instead, who the litigant is. Lusby was the plaintiff in the first case, and the United States is the plaintiff in this case.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. And this course actually...
If that's right, then our decision in Cole is wrong and has to be overruled.
I think that's correct. I don't believe that you considered this 3730B1 issue. In Cole, I can't find any place, and I know Judge Posner was on the panel, I can't find any place that was considered. But if you take a look at the Cole case itself, the Cole, too, it involves personal claims. This case involves claims for the United States. And as I was preparing for this argument, I found that in March of this year there was another case that came down in the Tenth Circuit that alluded particularly to some of the issues that were brought in this case, particularly the issue about whose claim it is.
Pardon me? You filed a Rule 28J letter with that?
I have not. I found it last night, Your Honor. And I'll submit.
Discuss it.
But anyway, our position is that it's a case of the United States.
Well, except that, I mean, this would be a different case if case number one had really been Lusby versus Rolls-Royce, and this were case number two, and instead of you standing there, it was an assistant U.S. attorney saying now the United States is trying to sue Rolls-Royce for the same defective turbines or whatever they are. There, the United States would not have been present in the prior case, but in these qui tam kinds of cases, it's more like both and, as we were seeing it in Cole. Had Mr. Lusby in the first case wanted to raise this very kind of claim, he could have done so and gone through the proper procedures for notifying the Attorney General and done all the things that he's now trying to do. So if you look at res judicata from the point of view of those things which are either done or could have been done, then aren't you back in trouble?
Well, the problem is, once he filed the retaliatory case, he couldn't go forward and file and join the Ketam case because you must file it under seal. The other side's not to be notified that there's a case going, and he's already got a case pending. How's he going to file it under seal without the knowledge of Rolls-Royce for the government? That's why apparently they chose to file a separate case.
Well, those are procedural requirements. Had he, when he's, I mean, I think the idea behind res judicata is a litigant is sitting there. Here's some mass of facts in the outside world that has disturbed this person. You know, and the person needs to sit down and decide what kind of litigation am I going to file about this. Now, maybe we were too harsh and cold. You know, I'm not going to say that can't be considered, but it could have been done all in one piece of litigation.
If it had been filed from under seal from the beginning, gave
the
government the opportunity, the personal case would have was set there. That's why there are a lot of cases that say you can file the subparagraph H case separately and you don't have to file the Ketam, and it can be separate. And I've run across several cases like that that say that's the situation. Who knows how this all unfolded and how we got to where we are about that. But the point is that Cole, too, involves she's realleged personal claims. That's not happened here. Clearly, Lesby, too, is a case brought on behalf of the United States government for fraud on behalf of Rolls-Royce and selling defective nonconforming turbine blades to the government. And that's clearly from the outset of his pleadings. When we got involved, we messed it up or brought it up another level and was more specific about the issues. I mean, Lesby's clearly alleged that they've been selling nonconforming parts for a number of years, that they didn't have the testing requirements, and hard point tooling was the main issue, and they just didn't have it, and they were selling these defective parts. That's even corroborated by the fact that the Air Force found out in 91 that was happening with regard to the four-stage turbine blades. But it's definitely a confusing mess, but with regard to trying to fit Cole into the situation, her case was filed
what's
after
about
this.
Your response to Judge Wood is, I don't see this. This doesn't seem to be the argument you were making in your briefs. I thought your argument in the brief was that this suit arose from different facts and that it was a different cause of action. And it arises from the same facts, and it doesn't matter that it's a different cause of action. But now you seem to be suggesting that because of the procedural requirements for these Ketam suits, there ought to be some special exception to res judicata, that somehow these suits cannot be brought at the same time.
Our argument with regard to the different set of facts is that the retaliation
well,
case...
Well, I know, but this argument you made in response to Judge Wood, is this something you've made before, or is this something you just thought of?
This has been our consistent argument, I believe,
I don't see that. Where's it in your brief? It's not in your...
We thought we artfully put that in there, but obviously we didn't. But the issue is that the operative facts necessary for the retaliation case is the fact that he complained, hey, we're not doing things right, to his management, was fired because of it, his allegation. The operative facts here are the details of how for years they've had improper testing methods, and they've been selling these products to the United States government for installation in aircraft for the Air Force and Navy, and the details of that. Those are totally different operative facts. And as I say, we think that the statute should be interpreted literally. It's kind of like a jurisdiction issue. Either you have it or you don't. Situation on the time of the filing of the particular matter. And here we have the filing of that order of dismissal, and they did not have government permission. It was absolutely required.
But we've already agreed that that's irrelevant, I thought.
Well, I don't know that I've agreed, but the court obviously has.
What you said in response to my question, you can't revive the first suit.
No, we're not trying to revive the first suit.
Oughtn't have been dismissed.
I don't know that.
It's you're slicing the mouse's tail off in pieces, right? Because first you try one. First, you try your first suit, your personal suit, and if that fails, you do a qui tam suit. And
Mr. Lesby did. We didn't.
Rolls-Royce has to defend twice these extremely closely related actions. Does it make sense? Well, unless you're right that it's somehow procedurally impossible to join them. Now, that's an important argument, but...
I don't know how you procedurally could
put that apart. I don't see how you could justify this.
Oh. Yeah, and as I read your brief, you do seem to be focusing on what you will argue are the factual distinctions between Lesby 1 and now this case Lesby 2, not on the fact that there is a res judicata exception for qui tam actions, which in my mind I can envision briefs that would look really different from these briefs. So I'm concerned about that as well. And I wonder if you could comment with respect to the res judicata point, too, about the weight we should place or not place on the fact that the government affirmatively declined to intervene in Lesby 2 and basically said we're not interested. Doesn't that?
The cases I've read said that does not make any difference. The government can come in at any time. If this court reverses...
Well, the government could come in tomorrow if it wanted to file its own case against Rolls-Royce. It's not precluded by Mr. Lesby's
actions. It can intervene in our case at any time. That's the rule on that. And the cases I've read on this topic...
You can't intervene in this case at any time. This case is over. The district court has dismissed it. You can't intervene in a closed case.
It could have come here in this appeal.
I actually don't understand why, if the district court is right, the United States could pursue this at all. I need to check to be sure I understand how QI-TAM litigation works. Suppose Smith brings a QI-TAM action against Rolls-Royce, litigates it to the gills, and loses. Final judgment is entered. Could the United States then bring a False Claims Act suit on its own?
I think they would have to participate in any appeal or any process case. I don't think so.
In my hypothetical... Smith, it's United States X Rel Smith v. Rolls-Royce. The United States doesn't intervene. It's litigated to the gills and loses. Can the United States later sue under the False Claims Act? I suspect the answer is no, and I'm very confident that Jones can't bring another QI-TAM action if Smith is litigated and lost.
That's correct.
But if the res judicata ruling here is correct, the doctrine of merger and bar, it's the same as if Lesby had, in case number one, brought a False Claims Act QI-TAM action and lost. And that has to mean logically that neither the United States nor anyone else in the world can ever bring a False Claims Act action, if the district court's understanding of res judicata is correct.
On this pattern, people in privity are... collateral estoppel or whatever. But
on this set of substandard engines and turbines and so on, whatever the focus of the cases has been, and it does seem to be the very same contractual flaws. We haven't even gotten to that, whether these are fraud claims or breach of contract claims or whatever they are. But it certainly seems to be the same problems that have led to both pieces of litigation.
I think that's the reason of this. You can't dismiss it without the government's permission rule, and Judge Barker has agreed with the government about that issue, so the government still...
Right, but that's what Judge Easterbrook was talking to you about a few minutes ago.
Right. Some of this stuff's pretty unclear, frankly.
If it's not unclear that if there was a problem in Lesby 1, it should have been appealed, but that's different.
If it was properly...
Once the government indicates it's not interested, then why isn't it just a case of Lesby's second suit? Government's out of it, not interested.
The fact that the government has not said we'll never be interested...
Well, but then this becomes ridiculous, right? Because now you're suggesting possibly three lawsuits. Lesby's first suit, Lesby's qui tam suit, then the government's qui tam suit. Three suits arising from the same facts against the same company. The law can't be that nutty, right, to permit that.
I think you're right, and I think the
government... Well, but then why do you say the government can jump back in?
Because
here, we've had two cases now. You're saying the government can jump back in. That would be the third case.
There's a statute.
Three cases against the same company, same facts, right? And that's what you're suggesting is possible.
I disagree.
Is that what you're suggesting is possible?
I'm suggesting it must be two.
You say the government can still jump in.
That's correct.
As Judge Easterbrook said, this case, this district court proceeding is over. That would be a new case. That would be the third case. Your position is you can have three cases against the same person arising out of the same facts.
I think that's a possibility with the government, but I think the government
has
to come
second.
In here.
But that doesn't make sense. We can't have three cases arising from the same facts against the same defendant. That doesn't make any sense.
There's a statute here that allows the government to intervene at any time. And the courts ruled that...
So you're saying the law is senseless and you can't have the three suits.
Well, I'm saying that the court dismissed it without
prejudice. No, that's your position.
Prejudice.
There can be three suits.
I think if we litigate...
Well, that's what you just said. There can be three suits because the government, even though this case is over... can jump in and have another case.
As it stands right now, the government can bring another case.
That's your position. Three cases.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. McConnell.
Thank you.
Mr. Weingartner.
May it please the Court, Rick Weingartner for Defendant Rolls-Royce Corporation. We agree with counsel for Mr. Lusby that Cole must be overturned in order for his claim to proceed. Even if Cole was overturned, which I don't think this panel has the authority to do, his claim would still...
We can overrule Cole.
All we'd have to do is circulate it to the full court and see if our colleagues agreed with us.
Mr. Weingartner, I'd like you to reverse the temporal sequence of this litigation. Suppose the first suit is captioned U.S. X. Rel. Lusby against Rolls-Royce. It's litigated, and the plaintiff loses. And then the second lawsuit is just Lusby against Rolls-Royce, saying you discriminated against me personally by firing me because I was pursuing case number one, or investigating case number one. Would case number two be dismissed on account of res judicata?
I think it would be, especially if the timing was that the alleged fraud that forms the basis of both claims occurred prior to the first key TAM action being filed. Because a factual necessity to bring a retaliation claim is that you had at least a reasonable belief that fraud occurred.
Well, exactly. All you need is a reasonable belief. There doesn't actually have to be fraud. But your argument, then, is that anybody who brings a key TAM suit had better bring an employment discrimination claim at the same time, or his personal claim is wiped out by his key TAM suit.
I think if, again, the facts are that the retaliation or the discrimination occurred...
Why should that be so?
Because it arises out of the same operative facts. Again, you have to show...
I should think not. The key TAM suit arises out of a fraud against the United States. The employment discrimination suit arises out of the fact that the employee was discriminated against for prosecuting the key TAM suit.
But
one would think these are different conceptually. They're two. It's easy to do one without the other. That is, easy to defraud the United States but not discriminate against an employee, and the reverse. And there are different victims. The United States is the victim of the fraud, and the employee is the victim of being sacked. Now, normally, in what seems to me just normal application of claim preclusion, those would be two different things. Different victims, different laws, different causal sequence.
I think
why should they be compulsory in the same case?
I think that Cole teaches that it's not a different causal sequence in the sense that if you are going to bring a retaliation claim, you have to discuss the facts in a retaliation claim. You have to discuss the fraud, at least that you had enough reason to believe that there was fraud. So the same facts that you're going to elicit in the key TAM claim are the facts you're going to elicit to show that you had the reasonable belief that you were furthering the act.
Well, look, think of a standard Title VII sequence. Jones gives support in a lawsuit filed by Smith claiming employment discrimination. There are two claims here. One is Smith's claim that Smith was the victim of discrimination, and the other sort of claim is the claim if the employer retaliates against Jones for supporting Smith, then Jones has a claim. If I understand what's going on here, the argument being made is that Jones and Smith have to file their claims together in one suit. And if Jones sues without Smith, Smith's claim is wiped out, and the reverse.
I think that in your scenario, Judge Easterbrook, there are two separate individuals. With regard to
that's the same problem here. We have the United States as the victim of the fraud, and Lusby is the victim of being fired.
But Cole held that the relator is, in fact, a party to the QTAM claim. So it is the same individual. There's the government that goes along, but Cole indicated and stated that both Cole is a party to the QTAM claim and Lusby is a party to the QTAM. Excuse me, that Lusby and the government are both parties to the QTAM claim. So you do have not the situation of Smith and Jones, but the situation of Smith, in which case to prove retaliation in this scenario under QTAM, you have to have proof and facts that there was at least
Maybe my understanding of QTAM is incorrect. That's why I said the correct title of this case is United States ex rel Smith on ex rel Lusby on the relation of Lusby. The real plaintiff here is the United States whom Lusby is representing.
That is,
we wouldn't say if the Attorney General of the United States had a personal claim that that had to be joined in a suit by the United States. The Attorney General represents on behalf of the United States, and here Lusby is litigating on behalf of the United States.
He's litigating
as a person.
Well, that's right. He's the agent of the United States, and I think the thing that's different about Cole is that the first case alleges illegal retaliation, and then there are, in fact, two claims in the second action. There's the QTAM claim, and the retaliation claim shows up again. So there are some differences to look at the actual structure of Cole. So one's presence in the first case as a relator is, I think, in a particular capacity. Just like if you were the guardian of somebody and then you later wanted to bring a lawsuit in your own right, you're wearing two different hats.
I think one of the distinctions is the fact that while you're representing the government in part, you're also representing yourself because of the bounty that the QTAM statute allows. You get up to 30% of whatever judgment there may be. So you
just
are,
like lawyers on a contingent fee, yeah, right?
But I think the way the statute is structured, that it is, and several courts, including this court in Cole, found that you are representing yourself and the government, and so you can be barred by the res judicata doctrine if you would subsequently bring.
The potential problem in Cole is that a bounty is not the same thing as the ownership of the claim. I want to ask you the same question I asked of Mr. McConwell about the res judicata effect of a fully litigated QTAM action. Jones brings a QTAM action, litigates it to the gills, loses on the merits. A week later, Green brings another QTAM action based on the same underlying claim of fraud. Can Green do it?
I don't think so, and part of that's going to tie into the original source concepts.
Let's suppose they got the information at the same time. Smith brings and loses, Green sues. I think the reason why Green can't file, even though Green had nothing to do with the first case, is because the QTAM action proceeded on behalf of the United States. The United States is litigated and lost, and Green can't sue on behalf of the United States.
With regard,
right? The United States is bound, and Green goes with it. But that also implies that if res judicata works the way the district court said here, the United States is bound by the fact that Lusby didn't bring a QTAM action. The United States can't litigate on its own behalf. If the only reason why Green can't litigate in my hypothetical is that the United States is bound by the outcome of the first suit, then the United States is bound by Lusby's omission of the QTAM action. I don't see how there can be any other outcome. Is there any other way?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think it.
But is that a sensible doctrine? Is it sensible to have a doctrine that says that if the Luspies of the world bring employment discrimination suits and omit a QI-TAM action that they could have brought, the United States is now disabled perpetually to bring a False Claim Act suit?
With regard to the specific allegations.
No, you don't want to argue that. That doesn't make any sense. What you want
wouldn't
to say,
make any
I
sense.
Think, what you want to say, I think, is that, of course, the government has a chance in the second suit to get in and take it over and so forth. But if they decide not to do so, then the second case really becomes the first case, unless there are additional facts that are important. But I take it there's no dispute that Luspie was fired, and the only question, maybe this is wrong, from your opponent. But as I understand it, the facts are the same in the two cases.
They are indeed. The allegations...
Are there additional...
There are not, because Mr. Luspie was fired in November of 2001. He has, the record indicates he has no knowledge of what went on after he was terminated. The retaliation case was filed after he was terminated. So the only facts that Mr. Luspie could possibly allege is what went on while he was employed, so they are indeed the same. As I said, I think Cole does dispositively decide this issue. In addition, Mr. Luspie simply failed to plead with particularity as is required by Rule 9b and the False Claims Act. He did not identify a specific claim that was actually presented to the government or a record.
What about your opponent's argument that it's just proceed? I mean, he barely mentions it in the brief, but that it's procedurally very cumbersome to join a personal claim with a QI-TAM claim.
I don't think it is. One, this court in Brostakowski held that in a typical case where you're bringing a Title VII claim or an ADEA claim where you have to go through the EEOC process, you can still bring your underlying claim and then add your retaliation claim if you go through that procedural process. In this case, there was nothing that prevented, the statute of limitations should not have prevented Mr. Luspie from subsequently bringing a retaliation claim, and it is entirely possible that he could have asked the court to stay the retaliation claim while it was still under seal while the QI-TAM action proceeded.
So are you presenting this 9b argument as an alternative to your res judicata argument, or is it only for the post 2003 facts?
I think it is an alternative to the extent it is for post 2001 facts. With regard to the post 2001 facts, Mr. Luspie has not alleged anything in the complaint that would indicate that he has any knowledge. So to the extent that the res judicata doctrine only accounts for things that occurred prior to November 2001, that Rule 9b argument also serves to allow that this case will not go forward. There are no facts that Mr. Luspie has alleged that will give any indication that he has a factual footing as to what went on after he left. So he didn't plead with particularity during the time period he was employed at Rolls-Royce, and he certainly pled no facts from which any reasonable inference could arise that he knew anything as to what went on after 2001. Again, for a False Claims Act, the key is showing a claim, a specific claim that was presented to the government, or a statement or a record that was made in order for Rolls-Royce to get paid. He has not alleged a specific claim. He has not alleged the content of a specific claim. He has not even adequately alleged an underlying fraudulent scheme. All he has done is, at best, make assumptions with regard to perhaps Rolls-Royce not following a contract or making a mistake. But a mistake or a failure to follow the contract is not fraud, and therefore is not covered by the Act.
A failure to keep one's contract is not fraud. But a statement, I am keeping my contract when you know you're not keeping your contract, is fraud. And it sounds like that's what's being alleged. What's being alleged here is failure to keep a contract while certifying to the government that you are, yet knowing that you aren't.
That may be what's being alleged, but it was not alleged with sufficient particularity. There is no basis for which reasonable basis for which Mr. Luspie to reach that conclusion.
So you mean it's your position then that Mr. Lusby would have had to say the certificate of conformance that you submitted on a certain date was fraudulent?
Yes.
That he would have to zero in to that extent.
And explain why it was fraudulent. And I think that is the holding of Fowler, where this court talked about you must plead fraud at an individualized transaction basis. Otherwise, it's just too broad, and under Rule 9b, you can't allege broad schemes of fraud. You must focus in on actual particularized incidents of fraud, and that requires...
So it's not enough just to say the certificates of conformance, every one of them that you filed during, whatever, 1998, was designed to mislead the government.
That is correct. All claims is neither specific nor is it, quite frankly, plausible. If all claims were fraudulent, then certainly there should have been details that Mr. Lusby could have alleged about the fact that if every single part Rolls-Royce made with regard to this turbine engine was faulty, he certainly could have alleged a lot more facts. And this court in Garst made clear that you can't get away with all invoices were fraudulent or all claims were fraudulent. You must focus in on specific, particularized concepts of fraud. Again, I think that Cole is clearly on point and dispositive, and that Mr. Lusby, because he alleged the same facts in Lusby 1, that Rolls-Royce was manufacturing and selling defective parts, is the same factual basis for Lusby 2, that this court should affirm the district court's decision that Lusby 2 was barred by the res judicata doctrine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.